From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. And joining us for the second part of this show is Dr. Jason Evans. He's the executive director of the Institute for Water and Environmental Resilience, and also the associate professor of environmental science and studies at Stetson University in Florida. Dr. Evans, thank you for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Great. Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me today.
Well, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to our first guest. We talked about the article in the New York Times yesterday, which kind of summarized the record minimum overnight lows being observed around the continental U.S., most specifically here in the out west. Nearly every western state had their warmest summertime lows on record. So just kind of a prelude to a warmer world. And now we want to talk about Hurricane Ida and maybe the effects that a warmer world had on Hurricane Ida's first generation and then intensity, path or so, and maybe its level of destruction that occurred. So let's start here. Let's start with its generation, because this storm intensified rapidly, like so many hurricanes seem to be doing these last few years. So let's start there.
Sure. Well, so this is something that we have really expected over the past 10 years or so within the climate change literature, that just basically with the warmer oceans and then the warmer seas, that feeds the hurricanes and it feeds the tropical cyclones to become stronger, to intensify, become larger. And so this was predicted by theory, and we are seeing it observationally as well. And Ida was unfortunately a very good example of this. Very rapid intensification within extremely warm waters within the Gulf of Mexico.
And those weren't just warm surface waters, right? That impact went much, much further down than we're seeing, you know, just when we swim at the beach or something like that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so with the warming of the world, that most of the warming is actually happening within the oceans. And so the oceans are really the heat sink, but the heat is still there. And so issues we see, like with rising sea levels, I do a lot of work with rising seas, and most of the sea level rise we've seen already has to just do with the warming of the oceans and the expansion that we get from the volume. And so, of course, seeing that within the ocean temperatures and feeding the hurricanes ends up being a secondary consequence.
Let's spend a minute again on that expanding water, seas, or the expansion of water. Talk about the physics behind that.
Sure. The physics, very basically, is that as you expand, or I'm sorry, as you heat the temperature up within water, the volume increases, and so the water molecules are basically be further apart until, well, you reach the point, of course, it's going to boil and it turns into a gas. But just with the warming of the temperatures that we've seen, you know, 1 to 2 degrees Celsius in some cases, that is enough to cause a pretty substantial increase in the volume of the oceans, and it's contributed to, say, on the order of 4 to 5 inches of sea level rise that we've seen over the past 100 years or so has just been with the warming.
Wow. Okay. How much more expansion could occur?
Well, as we go into the future, and we're starting to see this now as we think through the next 100 years of sea level rise with different climate change scenarios. But the warming itself, say by the year 2100, we might expect another 3 to 4 inches or so just from the warming. The big unknown is really going to be what happens with the ice caps. And so Antarctica, Greenland, and so that's just the volume of water, right, the mass of water that comes off of the land, the melting. That's where we can see really catastrophic, you know, 4, 5, 6 feet of sea level rise by the year 2100, and that would have to do with the melting of the ice caps.
Okay, so let's get back to Hurricane Ida, because it's like I say, this storm went from a tropical storm to a Cat 1, and you know, as anticipated, it was predicted. I remember seeing on like Thursday night or something, it was predicted to go from a Cat 1 to a Cat 3 over the next 48 hours. Instead, it went from a Cat 1 to a Cat 3, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, in less than 24 hours.
Yes.
It was intense, and that was overnight. You know, I went to bed, it was a Cat 1, I woke up, it was a Cat 3 or so, something along those lines.
Yeah, that's right. And so we've been seeing this a lot more. We've been seeing this happen a lot more frequently over the past 4, 5, 6 years, where we're seeing storms do this rapid intensification. And so this is something that has been known to happen, and we know the processes behind it. But what we're seeing is with the warmer waters within the Gulf of Mexico, and this one was actually very well forecast. Even 4 or 5 years ago, we were seeing storms that were going through rapid intensification, and it was more surprising, but just because that used to be thought of as a rather unusual event. But now we're seeing this rapid intensification happen more and more frequently. And unfortunately, we think this is just going to continue as we continue with the warming of the waters in the oceans, within the tropical oceans, within the subtropical oceans, that we're going to see this phenomenon.
How do we sort of prepare ourselves to either better anticipate or just sort of be ready for these kinds of storms, knowing that they're going to come again and again?
Sure. Well, with Ida, and one of the success stories maybe behind Ida, of course, it was a very destructive storm, and really up in the Northeast in particular.
Right.
But of course, following Hurricane Katrina and the massive storm damage that happened from the surges and flooding, that the good news with Ida is a lot of the projects, a lot of the investment that went into the strengthening of the levees around the areas of Louisiana, those mostly held. And so a lot of investment and understanding where the vulnerabilities are, understanding what are the actions we can take to harden our infrastructure against storms. And in some cases, in very, very vulnerable areas, learning where it might not be wise to have infrastructure there anymore. And so it's a very long, complicated process of identifying where the hazards exist, to try to anticipate them. And unfortunately, as we learn after big storms expose those vulnerabilities, then making decisions after the fact as to what we should do, with knowing the one thing that we do know is that we are going to be seeing a lot more climate change over the past, over the future 100 years or so or more.
Yeah, you know what? I think we need to shorten that time frame. You know, we're seeing it now. I mean, these are conversations, like you say, that were theoretical back in the early 2000s and even 2010. Well, we looked and said, you know, by 2020 we may start to see this. Well, here it is, and we're seeing it play out.
Yep.
In, like you say, stronger storms. Our first guest, Karen Gleason, talking about wetter summers in certain parts of the U.S. And out here, we're having, you know, record drought and temperatures.
Yep.
So that theory is playing out, and now resilience is becoming the next level of effort here with respect to these events.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so it really comes down to when it comes about climate change, whenever I'm teaching about climate change, I think it's more helpful to talk about climate changes or because each individual area, like say Utah, where you guys are at, with climate change, we have anticipated, most of the models have suggested getting hotter and drier with maybe very, very periodic increases of flooding in certain times. But the idea is the trend is it's going to be hotter and drier. Where I'm at here in Florida, we are now starting to see what was also predicted by theory, but we're now starting to see the observations that the intensity of rainfall events, and not even just with tropical storms, we'll see it with our afternoon thunderstorms we get here over the summer. Just actually last month, there were several events in some coastal communities where 3 to 4 inches in 45 minutes to an hour, not with a hurricane, not with a tropical storm, just a thunderstorm that was coming in, completely overwhelmed the stormwater systems and flooded houses. And so these kinds of events, we're seeing them more and more and more. And so every community, and this is no exaggeration, every community needs to be looking at what are the vulnerabilities unique to our area, and what can we do as a community, as individuals, as homeowners, what can we do to try to increase the resilience of all of our systems? And that's a very, very complicated question, of course.
And I imagine that maybe the folks thinking about, you know, hurricanes and sea level rise and things like that, that area has probably expanded. It's no longer the folks just living on a barrier island, right? Like you said, now we're talking about the impacts of these hurricanes in the northeastern part of the U.S.
Well, that's the thing with Ida, that was unfortunately a lesson in. Oftentimes when we think of hurricanes, we look at the wind speeds, and of course that is very, very important. 150 mile an hour winds, like with Ida when it came ashore, incredibly destructive. But hurricanes and tropical storms and tropical depressions, oftentimes the largest amount of the damage we get is from the water, either from the storm surge or, like as we saw with the Northeast, after Ida had traveled, you know, over 1,000 miles over land, we typically think of tropical depressions as becoming weak. There's not a lot of wind. But incredible amounts of rainfall because of all the energy within Ida, within just the climate system itself, and dumping 2 to 3 inches an hour in somewhere like New York City, and we see catastrophic flooding because the systems were not designed for that intensity of rainfall. And so those are the kinds of events that, again, they take it out of theory. That 20 years ago, when I was a graduate student, that there was still some debate, right? There wasn't a whole lot of debate, but some. But now the observation matched theory so much in really community after community that there's not really any excuse for not acting anymore because we can see it within our communities.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Evans. He is Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Studies at Stetson University in Florida. He's also the Executive Director of the Institute for Water and Environmental Resilience. I want to get back to these concepts of resilience, but just to put a bow on this storm that went through the Northeast, I mean Ida, as it went through the Northeast, Pennsylvania, New York. My sister lives in downtown Philadelphia, and the Schuylkill River topped its banks to where she had 7 feet of water in her street and in her lobby. She had to abandon her building. It was uninhabitable for 5 or 6 days. That's in downtown Philadelphia in a modern high rise. These are examples of impacts that again, like you say, Dr. Evans, just a decade or so ago, we're not expected to happen. Maybe once every, we talk about one storms that are one in every 50 years or a one in 100 year storm. What was the rainfall like in terms of one in what X years storm for the Northeast?
That's a really good question. I have to admit, I don't know the exact answer for that. But as I understand, within New York City, that the intensity that was measured with Ida, so the rainfall intensity per hour, was the highest on the record, as I understand it. And what is even more alarming is that the record had just been set not too long ago. And so we're seeing that, so like with stormwater systems, we'll oftentimes design to a 1 in 25 year storm, say for street flooding, or when we're thinking of like flooding for houses, we'll look at the 1 in 100 year storm, the 1% storm. And so, but what we are seeing is that what we had thought, you know, and what we had designed for, you know, 25 years ago, even 10 years ago, sometimes what's still on the books, you know, what we're designing to, these things no longer hold. That we're seeing observations of, say, you know, the 1 in 100 year storm happens in some area. We've seen, for example, in like coastal Texas, in some areas, we've seen the 1 in 100 year storm happen, you know, 4 or 5 times over the past 20 years. And so the probability of that happening is very, very low. So we really have to rethink, because of climate change and with these extreme rainfall events, that as we design our systems, and just kind of a rule of thumb now, like I'm talking with stormwater engineers, I'm talking with local governments here in Florida, if we want to be resilient, say for flooding, I say rule of thumb is we take whatever our standard is now, and we need to add a 30% factor of safety onto it. And I don't even know if that's enough. But what we do know is that our standards now are very much outdated for most of our areas.
And living, I went to graduate school in Florida and learned all about stormwater management, which is critical in Florida. And that book is obsolete, you know, from the 80s. Those hydrograph curves are done and dusted. They have to be all reset. I want to turn to this again, the idea of resiliency, this kind of idea of like, well, our town got whacked pretty good, but we're coming back. There's always, that's the word. It's like, we're coming back and we're going to build bigger and better and stronger than ever. I get it. I get that desire not want to leave or give in. But when does resiliency become retreat? You know, when is it?
That is an excellent question. And it's a very, very difficult question because I've worked in communities where that a retreat is starting to happen. And oftentimes retreat is happening not because people want to retreat, but because the impacts have become so great, and then just the expense of trying to resist the forces of nature just become too great. And then those processes where I've worked in communities like that, it's like a process of grieving that of course people are attached to their homes, and people are attached and have histories. And so it's very, very difficult even to talk about retreat, really. But then when I put on the other hat of when we think of expenses, we think of just even the reality of engineering. Oftentimes when working in Florida and then thinking about sea level rise, and we'll oftentimes look at extreme scenarios of 6 or 7 feet, which could happen by the year 2100. And as we show maps and we go through and we do these vulnerability assessments, of course, the question is, what would we do in that? And then my answer is, we're probably going to have to retreat. You people of the future are not going to be able to resist 6 feet of sea level rise if you're living in coastal Florida. It's just be too expensive. But exactly how that plays out and exactly when we're going to make a decision to retreat, whoever can figure that out is going to be a genius, and it's not me.
Well, Can you give us some examples of areas of Florida? You know, obviously one of the more vulnerable coastlines in the country, along with, say, portions of North Carolina or so, the Eastern Shore. Can you give us an example of communities that are saying, you know what, you can't live here anymore? This part of town is no longer habitable.
So we haven't quite got to that point of saying, well, you need to leave now. But there are certain areas in the Florida Keys, for example. I've worked a lot in the Keys, very, very low-lying. A lot of issues with tidal flooding, with sea level rise becoming very apparent. And so one of the examples there has been with roads. There's a lot of road flooding that's happening. It's increasing pretty much at an exponential level. And not with hurricanes, storms, just irregular high tide that happens on the full moon in the fall can flood pretty extensive areas of road. And so so the county looked into the idea of, okay, if we elevated all the roads that we needed to elevate to keep them dry with just, say, for example, 2 feet of sea level rise, which could conceivably happen in the next 40 years.
Okay.
That the expense of elevating those roads was just astronomical, absolutely astronomical. And so the county has started having the conversations that there are likely going to be areas where it's not going to be feasible with engineering or with economics to maintain roads and to maintain that access for certain areas. And so so those are the kind of conversations that are happening when it comes to retreat in Florida, that it's really going to be on the side of infrastructure, where local government saying we're not going to be able to afford to maintain the infrastructure that you have now if we have this amount of sea level rise.
As an ecologist, when I hear, you know, when I hear those kinds of facts and figures, I also think about, like, gosh, what valuable sort of habitat is being lost. Those shore areas that haven't been developed maybe as heavily are also going to disappear, that are so important to, you know.
Oh, mangroves.
Right, the mangroves, right. The seabirds, all these other kinds
those
of things.
Those nurseries, those marine nurseries.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. And so, yeah, we've worked on a lot of that modeling within the Florida Keys, for example, that mangroves are really interesting, because with a moderate amount of sea level rise, it might be good to be a mangrove. with a lot of sea level rise, then yes, it could swamp out the mangroves as well. But again, the Florida Keys is one example, because a lot of endangered species in the Florida Keys. The key deer is kind of a really iconic one a lot of people know about. With about a foot and a half or 2 foot of sea level rise, about 95% of the habitat for the key deer would be gone. And so then you get into the conversations of, what do we do with the species? You know, are we going to move it somewhere else? So we've had those kind of conversations in the Florida Keys a lot. Because, yeah, it doesn't take much sea level rise within some of these really low-lying areas with very unique endemic species that climate change becomes really an existential threat.
Well, I look at places like Port-Fourchon and Grand Isle that really got hit hard, and I guess a lot of people in those towns are asking themselves the question, is it worth it? Can I even afford, forget it, if it's worth it on kind of a historical or a cultural or economic, is it worth it on an economic setting for me to rebuild and probably not get any insurance anyway, homeowners insurance, because what insurance company is going to give me homeowners insurance living along the coast, that type of coast? So many factors in play that, you know, that I'm sure you cover in your environmental resilience, water and environmental resiliency center. So it's a very dynamic situation. I'll give you the last word. We got a minute.
Sure. Well, and And I think you really hit the nail on the head here. The insurance, when it comes to homeowners, when we get to mortgages, you know, are banks going to give you a mortgage to live in some of these areas if they think in 30 years that it might not be there? That's where we might start really seeing a lot of tipping towards a retreat is going to be on the finance insurance side. And so that, if I was to bet in terms of what retreat's going to look like, it's going to start from the top.
Dr. Jason Evans, he is Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Studies at Stetson University and also the Executive Director of the Institute for Water and Environmental Resilience. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And I have a feeling we may be talking to you some more before this hurricane season is on. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.